Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith. And today we are talking, we're segueing off of the conversation that we started having last Sunday about why voter turnout was so low. This week we're going to take and explore the reason that it was the economy, stupid, that kept people from coming out to vote. Today I have a co-host with me, Christy Harvey, who is actually
Hello.
A Georgia native from Greensville, Georgia. Christy, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Christy. To those of you who know me, I went to Greenville High School. Later on, I went to Tuskegee, majored in political science, and then later went on to get my master's. And now I'm living in Philadelphia, PA. I've lived everywhere, I think, across the U.S., and I've met so many awesome people. But here's the thing. Everywhere I've lived, I've seen one thing in common. Economic problems, especially amongst us as African-Americans, really across the globe, you kind of see the same trend. Then when it comes to, you know, the political arena, I tend to see the same trend when it comes to areas of voting and just the political power that we seek. So I thought it was a great idea that Scott was going to reach out to me about this topic, and I hope that many of you call in because I would love to hear everyone's perspectives. I think as African Americans, we really need to be open and honest about what holds us back, because we can't move forward if we don't really get this real truth out there. Let's talk about this stuff.
Yeah, you know, I know you listened to some of my show last week, and because we did spark the conversation between us. And, you know, we particularly down here in the South, and I know across the views, listening to all the different pundits from all the other different mainstream media sources, everybody was really looking at what the African-American turnout was going to be and was hoping that was going to drive Democratic victory 2 weeks ago. It didn't seem like that happened. And I was listening to a video earlier this week from former Labor Secretary Robert Reich, and he was talking about the economy. And I listened to that, and he was saying, well, since we have, you know, lower median wage growth in America, even though we have a so-called recovery taking place in our economy, those gains are going to the 99%. We've all heard that key phrase thrown around from here to there. But I wanted to take it a step further because I don't think that those economic models really hold true to the African-American community, nor the minorities, because there's a whole different economy for us. What you think about that, Christy?
Well, I just want to chime in. I was just going to interrupt you. And everybody, as you get to know me, you see that I'm good at interrupting people, which is bad. But I just had a conversation about this with a friend of mine. His name is Derek Tibbs. Used to work for BET. Derek and I were talking about the economy of African-Americans. And as black people as a whole, I don't even want to just say African-Americans, but mainly black people as a whole, is so different. If you look at the way the economy is set up to purchase, to build businesses, which most of us as African-Americans, we don't have the strength of building businesses in our community, which leads us back to politics. They go hand in hand. I saw something on Facebook the other day. Somebody had a picture, and this is how white people vote, and they had cash in their hand. They said this is how black people vote. And they had a check, mark the Xbox for vote. Now, I thought that was an interesting image. I'll tell you why. Because if you think about politics, it's about controlling resources. And guess who you need to get to sway your way? Are people in numbers. And why are we so important to the vote? It's because we spend a lot of money. We're the greatest consumers. But do we own anything that would actually help us in affecting the vote? Sometimes that question is questionable because sometimes we're just a number. We don't actually have a voice in the voting process. Yes, we are a number, but do we actually count when it comes down to dollars and cents? in the perspective of owning something. So this is where I sometimes am a little torn about where we fit into this economic and political system. And I wish we had some callers that would call in and give us their perspective, because
well,
I really think this is very personal.
I do have a caller sitting here. Let me get this caller on and let's see what this caller has to say. Good afternoon, caller. You're on Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith. What's your reaction?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Hello? Yeah.
Yes.
Welcome to Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How's everybody doing?
Everybody's gravy. You know how it is. So what's your reaction to that caller?
Very, very, very interesting topic that you're discussing at this point, in regards to voting, in regards to the black vote compared to the white vote. When it comes to economics, because racism is free now. They get racism for free. What's going on now is
Wait. Can you tell us more about this racism for free? What can you go a little bit more into that?
Well, we all know how black people came to this country. You know, when you fast forward that, now it's economics and class. When you look at economics and class, racism is thrown in there. Racism is a given. Look back after slavery, after black people or Africans have built this country or helped build this country on cheap labor, highlight cheap labor. Because once, you know, the invention of the cotton gin took the Africans out of the poppy fields or the cotton fields, if you may, it was transformed now into plants meaning car factories, car plants, where big corporations would set up shop in rural areas. And they set up shop by design in rural areas for cheap labor. Now, keep highlighting cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
Black people, cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens to those people in those areas? Those people in those areas, they get the rug pulled out of them. What, the corporations move in about, what, 1940, between 1940 and 1970, and once they get to a point where they're big, they close shop and they go overseas. Again, understand the model that is being used. They go overseas into another rural area, and they exploit the individuals in the country that the new country that they're in, taking place there. Again, each rural area is being sucked dry. You take Detroit, being sucked dry. You take Philly. You take places where here in the United States where we primarily dwell. This is where corporations come in, and they feed off of us like vampires, so to speak. And once they're finished, and you look at the community, the aftermath, look at the aftermath of Detroit. At one point, it was a flourishing community because of the jobs. What happens when the jobs go away?
I would like to interrupt you, Derek, and say that you have a very good point, because I myself have lived in Detroit. Detroit was like my second home.
Right.
One of the things that I noticed about Detroit is that, you're right, it was thriving at the time because of the plants. If anybody doesn't understand Detroit, you have the big three there. For General Motors, you have Chrysler, and I don't know, what was the third one? Ford, I think?
Ford, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have the big three there. So with the big three, what usually happened is you had all minorities that were doing very well because they were plant workers. Unfortunately, one of the things that I noticed in Detroit was there was not a lot of education amongst the black community. And when I say that, I mean higher education. So these people thrived off of the plants and then infiltrated somehow, and I don't quite understand how, but drugs became very popular amongst the plant workers during that time. Now that we have the recession and those plants are dwindling, most of them are now gone. Now you see Detroit in the horrible state that it's in. So I want to say, Derek, you've actually gotten that model down very well. Now, I do want to make a clarification. Being that Detroit is considered more of an urban area, when you say rural, I myself grew up in a rural area, and looking at that, I do know that there were a lot of plant workers. You had Goodies plant. A lot of African Americans worked for the Goodies plant. Now
right.
you have, I think it's the Kia plant in LaGrange,
yep,
which is a smaller.
And I was just getting ready to.
That's a very interesting, yeah.
Right,
and
now,
I was just getting ready to bring that up, too, because we sitting there where you're talking about rural areas. If you look at where the car plants that are coming into America today, where they're going, you're looking at when BMW first moved into the country. They went to Alabama right outside of Montgomery. Then you've seen Volkswagen move into Tennessee. And then, again, you had Kia, which moved right around the corner. It's right here in the county where I'm at, Tripp County. Kia moved in. And one of the things that you talk about with cheap labor, because when Kia first came down here, everybody was thinking, wow. I have relatives that work in Detroit, and when they were working for the car factories, they were making $27, $30 an hour. We finna get those type of jobs here. But when they came here specifically because they knew they could do a lower wage here. This was a right-to-work state. This was a place where they could drive the wage down. So you're looking at the Kia worker here starting out somewhere about $14, $15 an hour, and topping off at $24. They're not going to see the $27, $28, $30 an hour that the workers in Detroit see, because, one, they're never going to be allowed to unionize here, because if they did, Kia will pick up and leave. And they came to this area because the education model here had been toward that of manufacturing workers, because we had a tech guild beforehand. We was a textile area. And you've seen that, again, and Christy grew up right down the road from here, that you had workers who worked at Milliken or the Goodies plant or at one of those textile industries, and that's what they knew. So, and they, again, as she stated before, there was not a major drive for people to go get higher education, because why? They graduate high school, you go get a job at the mill, and you'll be good for the next 34 years.
Well, see, that was handed over from generation to generation, maybe two or three generations, when your father went and worked in the coal mill. The son may have gone to college or may have graduated from high school, but they wind up working in a coal mill. What's happening is that the shift, they still do it. The car factories or the car plants are now prisons. You know, prisons are being popped up, state-of-the-art prisons in rural areas, but in white areas, rural white areas. And the same model is being used there as well. Now, you talked about drugs. See, this is part of the war on drugs. Whenever you hear war on drugs, war, you have to underline war, the silent war that has been declared on you, black people, people of color. And I'm searching for a new word to describe us, because we're not crayons. When you say black, we're not crayons. We are people. You know, they didn't bring slaves over here. They brought people over here and made them slaves. There's a difference. And a lot of people don't understand the three levels of what it takes to make a slave going on back there, when you had the slave owner, the slave trader, and the slave maker. The slave maker is rarely talked about. But going back to what's going on now with the war, the silent war on drugs, the truth is it's the war on us. See, there's guns in our community. There's also guns in white communities. White communities with guns have a very good, safe community. The reason why they have a very good, safe community is because of the quality of education that's in that community, the quality of opportunity in that community, and the quality of jobs, the quality of careers. In the black community where there's guns, the quality of education is poor. The quality of opportunity is poor and questionable.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
My question is, you know, I think you bring, I'm really enjoying this discussion right now because I think you're bringing to the table a perspective of understanding. I think within the Black community, a lot of times we don't have a thorough understanding of what's actually happening in our environment. If you really pay attention, and I listen to a lot of my peers, and I just make observations of people, and they all say the same thing. You know, is there a way out of this? I don't understand why I'm not moving forward. I look over and I see these people doing this, and it doesn't seem like my life is going that way. And I think we often assume that because we are born in America that we will get a piece of the American dream. Our parents told us just to work hard and you will get a piece of that. Well,
right.
You know, I don't know how true all of that is because I did everything they said to do. I went and got a master's degree. I went to various Fortune 500s, but I never got past a certain point. Then it dawned on me after traveling to a lot of places that you've got to have your own economy. You got to have your own business. You have to have your own money flowing in and out. So
mm-hmm.
My question now becomes, how do we, and I think through this podcast, it's one of the ways, because now we can put those issues on the table so people can grasp what's actually happening to them. I don't think as African Americans that we really understand what is happening to us. I think we see the surface level of it from, you know, racism against, you know, with the police. I think we see the surface level, but we really don't understand.
Let me interject that right there, because you hit a point, you hit a button there that I think at one point we did, because if you look at the African American culture from the late 19-teens until the early 1960s, you actually seen there was an African-American economy that was growing. And it was growing because my grandfather, he owned the local
Street.
Neighborhood grocery store.
Black
and he
Wall
owned,
Street.
Right, he owned a several rental properties in the neighborhood. So he was not only the man in the neighborhood who fed the community, but he was also the man that put rule over their community, and he actually had enough money that he built the church in the community. So he had the ability to make a difference in his in that community. Not only he provided small jobs for people, there was, he had guys that went around and fixed up the houses, that took care of the grounds of the church, delivery boys from the store, employed my mother and her sisters to work in the store and taught them business, which they in turn taught to us. But when you had the desegregation movement, we went toward integration, it became a notion in our head that our own businesses were not good enough. And we started, again, we let that money leave our neighborhood, just like we let our votes leave the neighborhood. We don't even vote for our own if given a choice sometimes. It's like we don't like ourselves, so we give ourselves away to everyone else.
Well, we got to remember, we was always taught not to like ourselves, you know. And you have to, you know, that I even hate to bring this up because I know people want to forget. People want to have amnesia, historical amnesia. But do you remember Alex Haley's roots when they was beating Kunta Kinte to make him say his name was Toby? Well, the same
right,
way they beat,
right.
People back then to change their name to not like themselves, to be Toby, to be Tom. The same what they did, they beat them that way to accept the religion that they was forcing down our throats as well. You have to remember, back then they didn't let us read. It was a crime to go to school. You know, They, in order for us to be accepted, we had to be Christians. We had to be good Christians, highlight good Christians. And they beat the hell out of us if we didn't get it right. And they beat it down and they shoved it down our throats. And I want to talk about, when you talk about our children in our community, you know, our children, they're not dumb. They're not stupid. In fact, they're brilliant. The problem is that they're modeling what they see at home and in their community and in their environment. And all they see and their environment, as far as role modeling is concerned, is to be a rap star, to be an athlete, or be a drug dealer. Now, a drug dealer, that's nothing but an illegal entrepreneur, and don't underestimate the ingredients and what it takes to be that business person, that business mind, who understands so many different things when it comes to setting up shop. That individual, they understand so many dynamics of opening up a business. They just misguided. And it comes down to the environment, aspirations, and opportunity, you know. And a lot of our children, they want to be like Mike, but if this is all that they see, this is all that they're aspiring towards, you know. And you have to teach our youth. You got to teach our youth, you know. If you want to hang around with non-broke homies, you want to be number 10. You know, you have to give them the code of aspiration, which is hope. You know, the most dangerous people in this world is people without any type of hope whatsoever. You know.
Okay, Derek, we got another call. I'm gonna let them chime in.
Cool.
Good afternoon, caller. You're on Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith. Tell us about yourself, and then kick what you got. Caller, last four digits, 5330.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon. I'm in. My name is Paul.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just calling. I just started listening, and I'm just catching up to speed. So
okay.
Really just getting informed on everything and everything what's going on. But I have to say, like, I think us as blacks, I mean, we have a lot of work to do. I mean, we have done a lot, and we have reached this far. So I just think that we need to be more focused and just, I mean, build on what we are building right now.
It sounds like you're from the Caribbean islands. Are you from the islands?
Yeah, definitely. I am from
You're educated. You're from Jamaica. Jamaica's education system is underneath the British rule. Am I correct? Right. Let me ask you about Jamaica and what's going on in Jamaica. Your education system there, do they teach you anything about America's civil rights, the movement?
I mean, it's one of those things where you really have to, get out there yourself and read about what's going on.
Did you say yes or no that they do? The British rule system does cover civil rights in America.
Not really, to be honest.
Okay. See, this is one of the. If anybody's listening, this is one of the reasons why there's a division between our own people. You know,
definitely.
See, a lot of people forget the Caribbean islands were drop off ports. The original aborigines of the Caribbean islands are all extinct.
True.
Those Spaniards or people from European descent, that's where they made slaves. Those are those people who call themselves Jamaican, whatever they call themselves on the Caribbean islands, those were nothing but Africans who were dropped off at different ports.
True.
You know, and Jamaica. Panama, all these places. This is where they set up the auction box before the slave came to the Americas. So you didn't come to the Americas unless you was broken in, and you was broken in down in the Caribbean, which you know now as the Caribbeans. You know, so this is one of the reasons why there's a division even amongst African Americans and people from the Caribbean islands. A lot of people who know nothing about the suffering, the pain and suffering of the Africans here in this wilderness, when they come here, they look at us and they say, "You lazy llama bean, you. What's wrong with you?
You ain't never
you
told
don't
the
want
story
much. You never, you don't want anything. I come in this country for 5 years and I have my own business. And never really understand the dynamics why you have your business as an immigrant.
Yeah, you're right.
You know?
Yeah, you hear a lot of that inside of our community, whereas we blame them and think the government gave them something. And to tell you the truth, if you talk, this is not only if you talk to a Caribbean immigrant, but even if you talk to Latin American immigrants, they will tell you, your company, this country doesn't like them any better than they like us and did not give them anything.
No.
Now, you do have some immigrants that come in with that HN1 status that have certain skills. Yeah, they pay for them to come over here, but the average immigrant that comes here doesn't get anything from our government. What they did is they taken advantage of the environment that our country has given us to be able to move forward. And you have to think sometimes we have forgotten that. And I think that the reason that some Caribbeans come here with that drive is because they come from countries in which they have just won their independence. They've been independent for maybe now 50, 60 years, but they had to work and struggle to rebuild their countries after the colonials left. And so therefore they had this drive to make something better. And then they come here and they got that drive to make something better. And so they continuously have that drive, whereas we here have taken for granted that this is our country also. Let's take some ownership in this country also, because we've always been told that, you know, if you listen to conservative rhetoric, it takes our country back, like this ain't our country too. So we don't take ownership because we continue to allow them to put that narrative in our head that we are not a part of, so therefore, why should we take part in? And I'm glad that we're having this conversation because, again, I think it goes down to the crux of why we don't participate in the system, why we're not participating, why we're not engaging.
Well, here's the thing. When you talk about engaging and you talk about participating, if you notice the wordage that you're using, they're verbal words, that means action. Now, in order to have action, you have to have certain psychological fundamentals in order to have that type of action. In the black community, what it seems to me that has happened, not through conscious thought, but just through the erosion of our culture, is that we have sidestepped the fundamentals. It's kind of like you wanting to get up and be active every day, but you're not eating the proper foods. You need nutrition. You need the proper nutrition. But instead, you eat Pop-Tarts instead of making a decent breakfast. What has happened to us is in the same nature. We have sidestepped the fundamentals, which are having a family. Families, if you really look at economics, families are what make an economy thrive. If you look at any culture that is doing well economically, if you look at the Asian culture, if you look at your Caucasian culture, if you look at the Indian cultures, all of them have one thing in common. They produce families. We have sidestepped the main ingredient that would cause us to be economically viable. We now have decided that we can create our new family, which is a single household of a mother. We don't need a two-parent household. We sort of made up our own rules as to what a family is.
I want to elaborate on what Christy is talking about there. See, this goes back. This goes back to welfare. This goes back to child support. Welfare and child support was not originally created with black people in mind. When you go back to Claudine, you have to remember, the social worker would come to your house in those years, in the 50s and 60s. The social worker would come to your house, and you could not have a man in the house to receive welfare. You couldn't have a man in the house. You couldn't have electrical appliances. There's certain things that you could not have. This society has torn apart. Christy, you touched on something about what thrives, and a family is key. When I talked about how prisons are being put up and women are talking about not finding a man, well, we're all locked up. There used to be a little side joke. I'm from Harlem. I'm from New York. And a little side joke about Brooklyn. Brooklyn was always historically known to be, you know, a tough type of neighborhood. You know, guys would wild out, you know, shooting, fighting. highlighting, you know, Labor Day parade, what the activity that would go on down there. We used to joke and say that the women in Brooklyn are thirsty. Thirsty meaning there's a shortage of men because all their men were locked up. Well, when all your men are locked up, and historically it has been 60 million have gone through the system. 60 million, that number, who has a record. When you have a felony record over your head, look what's cut out. Look what you no longer have access to. You don't have access to housing. You don't have access to a job. You don't have access to food stamps. You can't eat. You know, and we talk about
right,
low class.
You're right, but what I'm saying is, and by the way, Scott, I think you had some additional callers, some people Facebook me, but
yeah,
they said they had to hold
on. I got one right here. Let me get in and chime it in.
Okay. Hello? Go ahead.
Okay. All right, Carla.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello? Hello?
Welcome to Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith.
Hello?
We can hear you. Go ahead, ma'am. We can hear you.
Go ahead.
This is Yvonne. What I want to say, I want to touch upon Christy. Hello, Christy. This is Yvonne.
Hey, what's up?
What I want to touch upon the family and everything. First of all, we have to go back where we came from. Historically, we came from slavery. So they destroyed the family. The Jim Crow laws, all that, Willie Lynch, is to destroy the family. Until we can get back to the foundation of what a family is and what we perceive a family is, we cannot be successful economically. And we wonder why that most African Americans have the resources, they have the money, but they don't know how to connect as a family. So if you don't know where you came from, you can't possibly know where to go. And as far as the black family, when you break it down from the male perspective and the female perspective, first of all, our perceptions of what our family is supposed to be like is totally not right. And black females have to be able to raise their families without a man, but the men also have to step up to the plate. We're no longer slaves anymore. We have a slave mentality. That's what we have. It's like having chains on your brain. So until
right.
we can go back to families like the church, like it used to be years ago, where they had rent parties, everybody helped each other, they looked inside their community for the help. So we have to start. We have to start first by training our young people, our young African Americans, to learn how to stick together, how to bring each other up, how to not worry about what the Joneses have. We have the Joneses mentality. If somebody has more than what we have that live on our block, we want to live in the house that they live in. And we don't go back and reach each other and bring each other up. That's the problem. So it has to start young in the home. And first of all, the mentality has to be there for the individuals who are teaching these young people and bringing these young people in the world. The mentality of the young people is get what you got to get for you. It's all about you.
Well,
so if you go back to the history and deep inside the community and start working within the community, not looking outside the community. It's nobody
yeah.
out there with a magical wand that's going to teach us anything. We got to do it ourselves. And when
yeah.
we
you know,
start accepting responsibility.
Wait a minute now.
I wanna go
She's
back
talking
and
about.
Hold on a second. Yeah, we got to go in here, and we got two areas here that we got to look at. Because Christy touched on his family piece, and there you sat there and touched on the part of the economy part, and you know they kind of rolling that together. Because see, you realize that what we think success is having a good job, and I was in a
right.
In a community forum.
That's the problem.
I was in a community forum. I was in a community forum maybe about a month ago, because we have a budding gang problem here in LaGrange, Georgia, which is about 45 minutes south of Atlanta. And we were sitting in there talking about what are the reasons we have these gang problems. Yeah, we talked about the single mother and the breakdown of the family. And we talked about, you know, education. We talked about that. But then I went and said, you know, because we know that the economy is key to this. I asked the question because everybody kept saying, well, we need training programs so they can get good jobs. And I stood up and said, well, we can't have training programs so we can have good businessmen. And everybody kind of looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, so we expect for them, meaning white America, Indian America, Asian America, to give us jobs. But what about us creating jobs for ourselves to give to each other? Because if you look at the average white small business, I want you to go in there and count how many African Americans work for them. But while we will start though, you know, and I'm talking when I told them businesses, I'm not talking about your barbershop or your salon, not talking about a car wash, not talking about a restaurant.
Brother. That's what. That's right.
I'm talking about a manufacturing facility. I'm talking about you starting a retail shop. I'm talking about you going out there, you creating a product and building that product and making good jobs. How about you go start an air conditioning company and it just not be you, but you have a fleet of trucks. How about you go and start a transportation company where you have
jobs
trucks that are loaded with goods that translate, that go across the country and drop
all
these
products. Let me just stop you right there. You mentioned most African-American women spend a lot of money on their hair and nails. Why is it that we're going to other nationalities to get our nails done? We're buying our hair products from big retailers. I mean, retailers that sell hair. I'm a licensed cosmetologist, natural hair. We don't go and shop. We get a hair place where you can buy hair and you can get your nails done. We won't go to an African American. It's the support system too. We also don't have the mentality to support our own people. And this is why we have this economic. It has nothing to do with white men. It has nothing to do with. It has to do with us inside of us. What we
Yvonne is exactly right. Let me just say this, and to the callers that don't know her, Derek, she's located in New Jersey. Derek and Vonnie, they're kind of from the same area. But I just want to say this. Vonnie touched on something that's very true and real. Even for this right now, for this podcast, to anybody who's listening, I just want to tell you a little bit about myself. Because as black people, we have to be real. You're not going to move forward if you're not real about what's going on with you. For me, I've been trying for years to figure out what would be the right way for me to go in life. Now, coming from an educated black family, they were taught, send your kids to college. I come from the South. The education is a big thing. So it was all about going to college. I went to college, really didn't know what I wanted to do, probably wasted 4 years there. Then I went on to get a master's degree. The reason why I did that, because I thought that was the thing to do. I really didn't know why. When I really look back over time, my greatest gift and talent was writing and speaking. Even my professors, they would say, your writing is beautiful. But no one in my family was realizing that because it was just, it wasn't an idea. Let's develop her talent. Let's develop her gift. It was, let's go to school. She'll go to school and get a good job. That was the thought process. So it wasn't until I decided to figure things out on my own, which took me through a lot of different changes. I can understand these people out here, such as Tyler Perry that was homeless, to all these people that went through struggles because they were trying to figure it out. They didn't have anyone to invest in them. Now, here we are today. Because of this podcast that Elliot started, he reached out to me. I said, oh, yeah, I can assist you. Now, the person on the phone that you're hearing, Vonnie, she has a hair salon in her house. She's very good at sewing, doing different things. She's trying to figure out what to do. In the process, she's had to take jobs to hold, you know, put food on the table for her family until she can figure that out. Here is what I think, and I think we have touched on something that could even be into another show. Businesses and African-Americans, what is holding us back? Because we've got to have a support system that says, hey, every one of us has a talent. We can make money off these things. But we don't have the support system. My brother there, Derek, who's in Atlanta, moved there from New York. You know, he knows everything about media. But right now, he's not in a position where that can be showcased. He's not in a position where someone can say, hey, this guy has talent. Let's get him on board. He shouldn't be struggling. So these support systems,
this
we desperately need them.
Collectively working together. And this is what Kwanzaa is about, that we don't get it. Collective works. Because Derek, down there where you're at, you got a connection now. You have the podcast to connect to other people throughout the country. And there's somebody out there just like you. There's a lot of somebodies out there, but we don't connect. This is what I'm talking about. We don't come together. And the reason why, it has a lot to do with slavery and the mentality that we have as African Americans. When we stop this mentality, you know where it's going to stop? It's going to stop at the babies when they come out the womb. Just like the Jewish people teach them about the Holocaust. What the hell does a 14-year-old know about the Holocaust today? You know what they know? They know what their grandmother taught them. They know what their mother taught them, and they drill it in their head. This is the Holocaust. We got a black Holocaust, and we don't drill it in their head. That's why we got young boys joining gangs, because they need to feel connected. They need to feel that somebody got their back. they don't have a father in the home. That's why we got girls running amok and doing all kinds of stuff. But until the community comes together, and the church used to be the standing. But until we start individually working collectively as families and not being jealous of what other people have, we'll be in a better position. And that's where I got to go, because I'm at work right now.
Brody just spoke on something
that's very important. And she's talking about love. She's basically talking about love. We have to start loving ourselves.
Love each other.
The dynamics is vicious, and the cycle continues. We collectively have failed our children. We failed our generation. We failed our people across the board. I think the generation before us has failed us. We failed to reach back to educate.
No, we didn't. We don't want to struggle to get to the progress. That's what the problem is. We got to go through the struggles to get to the progress.
This is what happens,
and we're not
Ronnie.
Failing. We're just our priorities are just screwed up. That's what's wrong.
Because there's a lot of us that have the education. There's a lot of us, because I know numerous people who have bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and some of them even PhDs, and they're still struggling. Because Chrissy gave hers. Let me get my story just a little bit. I was born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia.
I'm at work. I just wanted to come to the podcast and find y'all the support.
Thank you. I'll talk to you guys later.
I'll be on again.
God bless.
All right.
God bless. But
God bless you. Thank you for coming on. And I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. My family, on my mother's side of the family, my great-grandfather owned the store. But by the time the end of the segregation was over, my mother's parents wanted to go get a good job, and that's what they did, let the business fall apart. Now, my father's side of the family, they came from dirt out there in East Georgia. Farm, worked in the quarries out there in East Georgia, all of that. Had a drive, no college education because they got tired of living like that, came to Atlanta and started working in the paper mills. They worked in the paper. I had an uncle who worked in the paper mill along with my father and his brother, and this, that, and other, and decided they wanted to be in management. Couldn't do that. My father pushed for a union. Probably died because he was supporting the union. Because he died when I was 18 months old, and nobody really understands a man that could swim like a fish drowning. But that was installed in me from a young age that, guess what, you can be whatever you want to be. You're going to have to fight for it. Because those uncles went ahead and 25, 30 years ago started E. Smith Box, the largest African-American minority-owned corrugated manufacturer in the southeastern United States. And they raised us in that plant. We worked the machines, and we went into the boardroom. We were taught this. The majority of my cousins went off to college. Me, on the other hand, I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to go to the service, so I went to the service. But when I came out, I went to school. I'm not a school person. I like to read and get mine on my own. So I dropped out. But I've kept that strive in my heart to want to be something better than what I am. And sometimes you don't see that. And, the woman who just left us made a very important point. We have to be collective, because my family would have not have made it where they went if they hadn't decided to get together, work together, and then help my uncle build that business. They could have been like crabs in the barrel. Well, you can't go and we can't go. They said, no, we all go, and we lifted up. And then he brought other black families with him. He brought other Hispanic families with him. He brought white families with him. He built that business up. And so we were talking about, and I'm glad that I got you, Derek and Christy here, because, we sat back the other night, and we sat back and chat back and forth for a while because we got a business to build. Because that what happens here hopefully translates to what's going on out there, because we have a message that we need to give out. Because black America, it's time for us to grow. It is time for us to grow. And we all need to start connecting with other folks who can help us do that. And every once in a while, there's going to be a white boy or two, or a white girl or two that's going to come in there and go help us get where we got to go. But we got to be wanting it for ourselves, and we got to be business savvy about it. And we have to also realize that this economic power we got to turn it into political power. Because if we don't, we still going to have them making rules, them making laws to keep us in our place. And I'm finished with that little piece of the rant.
Hey, I want to just touch on something quickly, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but we are setting ourselves up to be wiped out. While we try to piece back the black family, know that it is already set in motion to remove us. You know, there's a direct relationship between having a business and being in prison.
So what do we do? My thing is, what we need to start looking at solutions. What are some things that we can do? You know, not to interrupt you, but I just saw on Facebook a couple of weeks ago a white woman with a really good heart who married a black man that was a felon, and she said she spoke to the camera and she said, "I want you guys to understand." Now, this is a white woman who's marrying our man that has a felon. And she says, "I want you guys to understand the Jim Crow law." She said, "This man that I married is not a criminal. He's there by design from the system. It was intended to place him there." Now, I'm not saying every black sister should go out here and get her a man with a felony record. Please check his background. Make sure he doesn't molest your kids. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is the men that are available that are out here, we need to start developing communities and groups that will mold them into being better people. There are a lot of black men that are out here that are free with no direction. I see them walking up and down the street every day, and I can visibly see that they have no direction. They're just hanging out. These men are available. They're free. They need a mindset to want to do something. You have women out here that don't even have a mindset to want to do something. We need to start molding. Even through these podcasts that we're having, we need to start targeting these groups of people, and we need to start talking to them about what they can do every day to make their life better, to unite these people together. I think there is a solution, but we have to really grab it now before it's too late. You really got to hone into that right now.
You know, some will say, when you say, Christy, what would you say if somebody told you it's too late? What would you say?
I would say that it can't be. I mean, here's the thing. If you can look at a generation of people that has their heads cut off, their feet cut off, and all of that, their genitals cut off, my grandmother, I wish I could get her on the podcast right now, which I probably could if I had told her. She's 97. Every day she tells me it's never too late. She tells me that every time I see her. She tells me it's never too late. That's because my grandmother has been through decades. She's seen integration. She's been through slavery. She's seen it all. She tells me time and time again. She says, "You know what the problem is?" She said, "These people don't have any direction. They don't." She wanted me to get my group of friends together to start something within our small community in a place called Greenville, Georgia. That's how much she believes that we could turn this around. And I believe it's true. When I look at the displacement of black men, I'll give you a prime example. There is a high school located in Greenville, Georgia. It is located about 500 feet away from a prison. Now, I lied to you not. I will go take pictures and put it on your blog. It is the high school. The high school is 500 feet away from a prison. The men in the high school don't say a word. No one protested. Now, these kids, I went to high school there, and I was considered an outcast because I was always presenting papers on genocide and all kinds of things, and I was considered an outcast at my high school. I've even tried to go in, and I asked one of the teachers if I could go in and talk to her group of students. She said yes. I went in and talked to the students. They were dead as a doorknob. It was like nothing was going through their heads. But I believe if we could find a way to grab these people while they're still young, while they're still viable, before it's too late, you can save them in some way. I just think that there's a system that doesn't allow that to happen on a daily basis. So here you are. And it said a lot to me. I drive past that high school every time I go visit my grandmother, and I think from high school to prison, that's what it says to me. You're 500 feet away from the prison. I don't understand that, and no one protested.
And you do realize your county has a very high instance of high youth unemployment.
has a very high instance of those young men going to prison. I was just looking at that a couple of weeks ago because Chris's hometown is right across the – I mean, I can be in Greenville in 20 minutes. We are right across the border from one another. I mean, so I've looked at that because that county is only 28,000 people there. The vast majority of it is African American, but it's a, what we call a class one county here in Georgia, which means it's like a poor county. But the people are not really poor; they just don't have resources. And those, and then
they have no resources.
Right, they don't have resources. And so then, you know, at least they don't know, have a way to utilize those resources. But then, you, like she said, that high school is sitting right there next to a prison. And I only think you realize that if you go a couple of, if you go about a, not even a quarter mile away from there, you have a mental institution down the street from them. You got Pathways. Pathways Mental Institution is right down there. If you look at that, if you, I don't even know if you paid that any attention, but there's a mental institution right down the road from there. So you got a really messed up situation because you got kids that are being, and it's a youth institution at that. So you got kids being routed from their high school to the mental institution, probably not getting good treatment, then being routed back to the high school, get in trouble. They graduate, they ain't got no possibilities of anything, and then being routed right into that doggone jail. And then that jail robs them up, probably up to a higher facility from there, because I know that they just hold people down. And then you don't have.
And let me just chime in on that about the mental institution to show you how real that this system is that we're up against. But it's not too late. My grandmother's oldest son, who's very successful, he works for government for customs. He was like one of the highest officers in the military. He grew up in that county and went to school in that county. My grandmother said when the principals asked her if they could integrate her kids into the new integrated school, she said yes. What happened is they put her son in a mentally retarded class. She said every day her son came home, and she said, "Why don't you have any homework to do?" He said, "I don't know. They don't give me any homework." She said she called up and, "Why doesn't my son have homework?" She found out that they had put him in a class for mentally challenged people. My uncle is not mentally challenged at all. Now, consider this. If my grandmother, the question is it too late? If my grandmother had not been cautious enough or insightful enough to pay attention to her kids, yes, it would have been too late. I think my uncle would have been in a whole different set of circumstances. But because she fought for him, she said she had to call the principal and basically curse him out to get her child out of a mentally out of a class for mentally challenged people when he's not mentally challenged. So he's gone on to college. He served in the Air Force. So how can he be mentally challenged? Now, you're talking about one insight that I have. So think of all the many other black males that you have that are going to be headed towards the same path. They're mm-hmm. already there. So I think if there were a system of overseers, of oversight to see what's actually happening, but parents don't pay any attention to their kids. Their kids are probably stuck in a class right now for mentally challenged, but they don't know it.
Well, what about the families, the black people, the black question mark that are suffering from depression, the undiagnosed people?
This is where we open up the gateway for people to come and talk. You see, this is one of the greatest things I've learned. And Dr. Kite, you're out there. I hope you know that I'm crediting this to you. I know a black man by the name of Dr. Kite. I met him when I was getting my master's degree. Dr. Kite went to Tuskegee University. Day of my master's class, he sat all of us down because he could tell that there were problems that we weren't talking about. You know how it is when you go visit your family and everyone's got some stuff going on with them, but no one talks mm-hmm. about it, so everybody tries to act like everything's okay. It was the same mm-hmm. way in that classroom. One day, he stopped the class. I guess he said, "I can't take this charade anymore." So he said, "I need all of you to be honest with me about what's going on in your life." He said, "Because here's the situation. In life, you have valleys and mountains." He said, "In order to get to the mountain, you got to go down in the valley." He said, "But you got to talk about it first. Because if you don't talk about it, you're going to try to skip over it, and you're going to fall right back down into the valley." He said, "No, I need everybody to air their dirty laundry right now so we can figure out." Now, here was the amazing thing about it. The girl next to me, she was coming to class every day, didn't have a computer, and didn't have a job. I had no idea. She was a cute girl. She was dressed to the nines. I had no idea this lady was struggling like this. She said, I have no job and I don't have a computer. So Dr. Kite said, okay, somebody in here help her get a computer. There was a guy who said, I have an extra one in my basement. I'll give it to you. He told her how many resumes that she needs to put out a day before she could get a job. Within a few months, that same girl had a job and she had a computer. He asked me what was my problem. I said, well, I've been evicted because I'm trying to go back to school. My car just broke down and I'm struggling. He said, I want to thank you for having the courage to stand up and even tell that to us. He said, now, I'm going to help you. He helped me get a job with that university, and I was able to stay there and focus. The next lady beside me, she said, I don't have a dollar to my name. I gave her a dollar so she could go to the vending machine and get her something to eat. Now, he said, from this day forward, when we all get our problems squared away, we're going to be able to focus on what's important. Right now, you guys focus because you're so worried about other things. I took a valuable lesson from that. We as black people have got to stop pretending. We've got to come to the table before we can even think about voting, before we can even think
right.
about getting married. We have to be honest
right.
about what's actually going on in our lives so that we can climb up out of the valley. Because here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't know that you're struggling, guess what? I can't send you the proper support to help you. If
right.
I don't know that you are without a car, guess what? I can't say, hey, I got some connections. Maybe I can help you get to work. None of that can happen. So we've got to be honest about where we are. And the problem with black people is we're not honest. We're too busy pretending. You're pretending
prideful.
To be something you're
pride.
Not.
Right.
Yeah,
you
and that's what I honestly think. Right.
And you know what? I
yeah.
could identify that. I could identify with having too much pride. There was a time where I thought I was a man. And I think many black men can relate to this, and they probably won't even admit to it. But I'll admit to it. For years, I thought I was a man when I truly was not. I was womanizing, abusing drugs. I was fronting. I was acting like a man, but I wasn't a man. I failed to create my own nest. You know, many men, when we leave home, when we leave mommy's home, we don't set up shop. Of our own place, acquiring our own place. We go from mommy to the next mommy, you know, and we buy into the idea of half. You know, we're going to partner up with this young lady, and we're going to split everything down the middle, 50-50. When truthfully, before we step to a woman, before we even try to court a woman, we should have our own first. And
right.
that's something that I failed to do. I failed to acquire my own apartment, have a job, have my own apartment, a relationship with God. I didn't come to women correctly. And I wonder why my relationships were failing, why I was failing, why I felt like I was always a loser when it came to relationships, because my priorities weren't right. So
right.
I say that to say, just because you're 18, just because you're 21, just because you're 30 does not make you an adult, does not make you a man.
Well,
we got 90 seconds
left in the show.
Well, I want to
so
say thank you for
you,
having this.
I'm going to be left before you leave, I thank you and I appreciate you coming on because guess what you just did? You just gave me the idea for our next show, and I want people to be able to listen in next Sunday because we're going to talk about this mental breakdown because – we've been talking about up for the last 5 weeks. I've been leading us up to why we not voting and how we're supposed to vote this, that, and the other. But what people fail to understand, the state of politics is the state of how people live. As long as it connects with economics. So what we're going to do is we're going to figure out ways to get together, conversating and getting people listening in. We're going to figure out how to get our people out of this hole. So I appreciate that. And so we're going to talk about this pridefulness and maybe what we need to talk about next week is what it means to be a man. Because I got a story that I want to tell there too. So, and I mean, we need to work on that, make sure that happens. So next week, people, y'all get ready to listen in. We're going to talk about manhood in our community and how that fixes us up because where we ever going to be the people we ought to be and be able to take power, we got to understand who we are first. And I thank you, Christy, for coming in and co-hosting with me. I hope this thing
is.
And everybody, this is Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith. See you again next week.
And we're out.
We're out.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you. Appreciate it for having me.
Thank you.